Welcome to this continuing medical education audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of AIDS 2020 that provides a quick audio summary of the most essential data presented at AIDS 2020. This independent CME activity is jointly provided by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. Support for this program has been provided by an independent educational grant from Gilead Sciences Medical Affairs. This program is produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. It is not a session created by or presented at AIDS 2020, and it is not sanctioned by the organizers of AIDS 2020. Please review the complete CME information for this program, which can be found on the program homepage, including participant disclosures and instructions on how to receive CME credit. To submit questions, please send an email to viraledcme@viraled.com. Questions will be answered by one of our faculty panel members via email within 72 hours. Thank you for your time. The podcast will now begin.
Hi, this is Ian Frank from the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm going to share with you some highlights on prevention and hot topics from the virtual AIDS 2020 conference. Let's start by talking about some of the early events in the HIV continuum of care, and we'll focus on some data from New South Wales, Australia, where they've had a very aggressive program to try to decrease the number of new cases of HIV since 2012, with components that have included policy changes, an increase in testing services, workforce development, and health promotion. And what's been seen over this period of time is an increase in the number of individuals being tested for HIV, an increase in the number of tests performed among those individuals at highest risk for HIV acquisition, and an excellent linkage to care program with an increase in the number of individuals in care from about 5,000 in 2010 to over 50,000 in 2018. What's been seen is a decrease in the number of new cases of HIV that has occurred over this period of time. And it's not only due to better testing and linkage to care. PrEP services has also been an important component of the program. And there are now over 25,000 PrEP users in the most recent quarter. So let's talk about PrEP. And I want to share with you some real-world data from Northern California, some data from the Kaiser Permanente Health System that have tracked almost 13,000 individuals that have been linked to PrEP care. The demographics of the population are 95% men and half are white. If you look at the PrEP care continuum, what you see is that about 80% of the number of individuals linked to PrEP care have been given a prescription. 83% of that population has started PrEP, and 73% of that population has persisted on PrEP. So it's about 48% of the number of individuals linked to PrEP care that have persisted on PrEP. And the rate of HIV acquisition in the cohort is related to the probability of individuals taking PrEP. So there are 6 out of over 4,000 individuals that have persisted in the PrEP group that have gotten HIV infected. That's a HIV acquisition rate of 0.14%. All of these individuals have reported suboptimal adherence. The rate of HIV acquisition is about 10 times higher for individuals who stop PrEP after its initiation, 5 times higher for individuals who were prescribed PrEP but never started on therapy, and 10 times higher for individuals who were linked to care but never received a PrEP prescription. So PrEP works when people take it. How can we increase the number of individuals who are willing to adopt PrEP? And one way may be to make sure that people understand the flexibility of PrEP. We're all familiar with the need to take PrEP daily as recommended or has been approved in the United States by the FDA. But in Europe and in other locations, PrEP is given intermittently. And there was some data from a San Francisco program where patients who were on PrEP were educated about taking it as it's done intermittently with a 2-1-1 fashion, 2 pills before sex, 1 the following day and 1 the day after that. So individuals in this program were counseled on taking PrEP 211, and they were told that taking it in this way intermittently is equally effective as taking it on a daily basis, which data has borne out. And what was observed is that about 3/4 of the population elected to take PrEP on a daily basis, but among individuals who were new to PrEP, 30% elected to take it in this intermittent format. And a small but significant percentage of the population only took PrEP because they became aware of the 211 strategy. So increasing patients' awareness of how to take PrEP may improve its uptake. There was some data looking in Southern African women at attempts to incorporate PrEP utilization into standard HIV prevention services. The ECHO study began by offering intensive HIV prevention counseling, condoms, STI testing, partner management, and then referred these women into PrEP services. There was a stakeholders meeting in March of 2018 which recommended prescribing PrEP on site. And after doing that, they decreased the rate of HIV incidence by half, from about 4.65% of the population to 2.16% of the population. So integrating PrEP services into other medical services may be important in decreasing the HIV acquisition rate. There was a study looking at a mobile health app to try to promote HIV testing and PrEP uptake among young MSM in San Francisco. And the app worked by increasing HIV testing, but it did not increase PrEP uptake compared to routine PrEP counseling and education. So we need to understand better ways to facilitate PrEP uptake. But the real blockbuster presentation at this meeting that may influence PrEP utilization was the results of the HPTN-03 study. This is a study that focused on MSM and trans women who were engaging in high-risk HIV acquisition behaviors. The target enrollment included 50% or more of individuals aged 30 or less, and 10% of the population had to be transgender women. The study randomized individuals to take daily TDF-FTC or to start on oral cabotegravir, and then if that were well tolerated, after 5 weeks of oral therapy, to switch to injections at every 2-month intervals. And the results showed that injectable cabotegravir reduced the rate of HIV acquisition by 66%. There were 13 infections in the individuals who got injectable cabotegravir. They fell into 4 different kind of categories. There were 2 individuals that got infected prior to study participation. There were 5 individuals that were infected after discontinuing cabotegravir injections. There were a couple of individuals who got infected during the open label phase, and there were 5 individuals that, despite getting regular cabotegravir with on-time injections, they became HIV infected. So there's more that we need to understand about how to use this intervention more effectively, but the results suggest that this is a better form of PrEP prevention than taking a daily pill. Similar benefits were seen irrespective of the population, irrespective by age, whether a participant was a transgender woman or an MSM. It was similarly effective in Blacks versus non-Black populations, and it was similarly effective irrespective of the 4 continents on which people participated. There was some new data looking at PrEP in the era of COVID-19, and not surprisingly, there were more lapses in PrEP utilization, and that was in part due to the fact that individuals were not as sexually active. In a survey of PrEP users across the United States, 57% of the population reported not having sex at all during periods when they were observing social isolation. But a small proportion of individuals still engaged in at-risk behavior, some individuals using apps to find sex partners, but in general, the number of sexual partners declined substantially. And then lastly, a very interesting case of possibly an HIV cure. This was an individual who was started on antiretroviral therapy after diagnosis in 2012 with a viral load of about 20,000 copies. And then in 2015, participated in a pilot intervention study where their treatment was intensified with dolutegravir, maraviroc, and nicotinamide, a latency-reversing agent. After a year on that therapy, the person went back to standard antiretroviral therapy, and about 2.5 years later interrupted his antiretroviral therapy entirely. The person has now undergone 64 months of observation off therapy with an undetectable viral load, and he has no virus that can be cultured from PBMCs and a waning antibody titer. So perhaps this will be the Brazil patient, the third reported cure of HIV. Thanks for listening.
Hi, my name is Jürgen Rockstroh from the University Hospital in Bonn, Germany, and I'm going to report back from AIDS 2020, which happened all virtual, and I'm going to cover areas hepatitis, tuberculosis, and COVID-19 co-infection. And the first thing I have to say is that around hepatitis C, there wasn't really that much new, or hepatitis B. Obviously, there are other topics as the pandemic is unfolding. One of the interesting late-breaker posters was on the incidence of hepatitis C reinfection following hepatitis C spontaneous clearance or successful treatment among HIV-positive MSM from the MOSAIC cohort study in the Netherlands. So this is a trial which really follows a large number of HIV-positive MSM and examines clinical behavioral risk factors which are associated with hepatitis C reinfection. And what is really quite impressive is that, first of all, the rate of reinfection is pretty high. It's around 25% after 2 years. So really telling you that patients who got acute hepatitis C with HIV really remain at a high risk of developing a new episode. And that risk increases even further if you have a first reinfection, and you're even more likely to get a second one, which almost approaches 40% over time. So that's a real relevant risk. And the determinants of hepatitis C reinfection are resective condomless anal intercourse, sharing of sex toys, and those two are really the most prominent risk factors, group sex, anal rinsing before sex, injecting drug use, and also a lower CD4 count contribute to higher rates of reinfection. So clearly, in the attempts to achieve hepatitis C microelimination, these things have to be taken into account. And we hope that the recently conducted consensus conference on recommendations how to treat acute hepatitis C, which ended up with a pretty strong vote for treating recent hepatitis C infection immediately after diagnosis to prevent further spread, will help to enhance and lead to microelimination, which is achievable, but clearly reinfection poses a risk to this effort. There were quite a number of TB studies presented. I just want to highlight some of the key findings here. You have all probably seen in the New England Journal the NIX-TB phase 3 clinical trial with the VPAL regimen, which is protominid, bitaquiline, and letazolid, which is really a relatively simple regimen for multi-drug or extended drug-resistant tuberculosis. And you saw excellent response rates on around over 90% overall. So clearly showing that we finally have a good treatment option for these previously very difficult to treat patients, and that in a relatively short duration and with a relatively simple pill count. And what they present here at the AIDS 2020 conference was really a sub-analysis in HIV-positive patients versus HIV-negative patients, as you might think that these patients have a lower response rate. But fortunately, it turned out that the response rates were overall very similar, and so there's no reason to believe that HIV patients respond less favorable to the therapy. Drug interaction-wise, there are some issues with the efavirenz, but these patients were switched mostly prior to commencing this regimen to buzetlapinavir and nevirapine, and that seemed to work very well. Then there was a study looking at risk factors for hepatotoxicity in HIV-infected women receiving isoniazid preventive therapy in pregnancy and postpartum. So this were pregnant women from an area with a high TB burden, and they were either randomized to immediate IPT, so they initiated entry isoniazid 300 milligrams daily for 28 weeks, then placebo, or they had deferred IPT, so they started on placebo, and then after week 12 postpartum, INH was commenced with 300 milligrams again daily. Now, there was quite some women who developed maternal hepatotoxicity by treatment arm, which was around 6% for each arm. So that seemed to be sort of comparable between the two arms. And then they really did a very nice analysis of risk factors associated with hepatotoxicity, including very detailed pharmacogenomic analysis, and were able to show that slow efavirenz metabolism was associated with high rates of hepatotoxicity, more liver toxicity with nevirapine versus efavirenz and with cotrimoxazole prophylaxis. So really showing that there are some risk factors, and obviously it's critical to monitor for hepatotoxicity in postpartum when most events occur. Then there was a follow-up analysis from the RELATE-TB2 trial. This is a NRS trial, which was presented at a major conference previously. And you may remember that efavirenz and raltegravir were compared in patients receiving complementing TB therapy. And unfortunately, raltegravir did not reach non-inferiority when compared to efavirenz. And so this study looked a little bit at the factors associated with virologic success. And patients who were more prone to respond were female, had a lower HIV RNA viral load, and importantly, also had significantly higher pill count adherence ratio, and that was particularly low in patients with the raltegravir treatment, as you might imagine, to the necessity of taking several raltegravir tablets, and as such, that may explain at least partially why non-inferiority was not reached in this trial. Now, there was really a lot of presentations, very exciting, around COVID-19. First of all, there was one national cohort study. So far, we only have data from UK and some cohorts in China looking at national COVID-19 outcome. This Spanish study analyzed the characteristics and predictors of death in hospitalized patients with COVID-19 in Spain, where over 4,000 patients were included. Remember, these are all hospitalized patients, so clearly a sicker group. If you look at the outcome, 28% died, 64.1% were discharged alive, 7.8% remained hospitalized at this point of analysis. Predictors of death were quite a few, included male sex, older age, arterial hypertension, obesity, liver cirrhosis, chronic neurologic disorder, active cancer, dementia, dyspnea, confusion, lower oxygen saturation, higher white blood cell counts, lower platelet counts, prolonged INR, lower EGFR, and higher concentrations of CRP. So this is one of the first analyses showing that there actually are some lab indicators of unfavorable outcome as well. And then there was really a lot about COVID-19 comparing outcomes in HIV co-infected versus non-HIV infected individuals. One of the largest studies to date was the results from the Veterans Aging Cohort study. This includes almost 31,000 people living with HIV, 76,700 uninfected individuals, and not all of them obviously were tested for COVID-19. It turned out that people with HIV were more likely to become tested. Overall, 8.4% of the HIV-infected individuals were tested versus 6.5% of the uninfected. And then the COVID rates were sort of comparable, 0.8% and 0.7% respectively. If you look at the outcomes, hospitalization, ICU admission, intubation, and death, that all was very much similar. So there was no evidence of increased risk of severe COVID-19 outcomes by HIV status. There were also some smaller studies, again, comparing outcomes of people living with HIV hospitalized with COVID-19 with matched HIV negative from a tertiary central London hospital. Patients were matched 3-to-1 by test state, age, same gender, and socioeconomic index of multiple deprivation decile. And again, there was really no difference in all outcomes, including death and ventilation and so forth. One of the interesting studies from London also showed that Black ethnicity was a risk factor for hospitalization with COVID-19 people with HIV. So somehow there seems to be a more unfavorable outcome in Black patients. And then really one study which received a lot of attention was a cohort study from Western Cape looking at COVID-19 and the impact of HIV or tuberculosis co-infection. Now, the Western Cape routine public sector has set up to collect data of really an impressive amount of patients. They have data of around 3.5 million people captured. And so they have a large number of individuals to look at and capture a lot of data around people who had COVID and also existing co-infections with TB or HIV, and also were able to show rates of people who had diabetes and hypertension, chronic kidney disease. Now, of note, There were around 50 with HIV who deceased, 510 who deceased who were HIV negative. Most of these patients were in the older age groups, and there was clearly high enrichment in both HIV positive and HIV negative patients dying from COVID-19 for diabetes over 50 to 60%, hypertension over half of the patients, and then to a lesser extent, chronic kidney disease and chronic pulmonary disease, and then also with TB. Now, if you look at the adjusted hazard ratios for dying from COVID-19, interestingly, in contrast to some of the work I showed you before, where there was no difference in outcome for COVID-19 related to HIV co-infection, there was a higher risk, which was twofold higher in the HIV-positive individuals. It was also higher for people with current TB, which was 2.7-fold higher. So clearly, this is one of the first studies in a very large patient number suggesting that indeed there may be a higher risk of dying from COVID-19 HIV. Fair enough to say, though, that obviously ethnicity may contribute to the increased risk of dying from COVID-19. So that is one question. And then the rate of comorbidity is extremely high, and patients who died were very much more likely to have diabetes or hypertension. And this may be more prominent in the South African patient population than some of the Northern American or European patient populations. Diabetes has emerged as a real problem in South Africa. So this is something to follow up on. They also looked at the effect of different ARVs following a paper from the Spanish group showing some protective effect of TDF. And they also saw some lower risk for dying from COVID-19 in people who were on TDF, but they also argued that patients who were more complex were on second-line regimens. So this may be also biased. And so they sort of are saying that they have to be very cautious in the interpretation of these results. And then I just want to close with pointing out there was a little bit of data also around the use of remdesivir, which has previously been shown to be working very well. Also in the shorter treatment duration of 5 days versus 10 days was equally effective. And now they looked at the clinical outcomes, which were measured on a 7-point ordinal scale, including 1 death, 2 invasive mechanical ventilation, 3 non-invasive ventilation, 4 low flow O2, 5 room air, 6 room or no ongoing medical care, and 7 not hospitalized, and to see whether there were changes in this scale. And factors which were associated with clinical improvement was lower age, ethnicity, being outside of Italy, and other factors. So it's kind of interesting to see how that plays out. And the regional differences may reflect the overburdened healthcare system in Italy, particularly in the beginning of the epidemic. There are still quests around racial differences and clinical improvement which need to be further explored. And then just closing with one final remark, because there was one interesting study on soft DAC, so hepatitis C drugs, which were used in Iran for treating very severely sick patients with COVID-19. And indeed, they found that this hepatitis C drug combination was associated with a faster discharge from hospital, improved survival in a combined analysis of 3 trials and 176 patients. However, not all trials were properly randomized, and the overall sample size was relatively small. There was no viral load data collected. So I think there's some limitations, but clearly this is one of the first trials which shows a difference in death rates. So that is something to explore further, and larger studies are currently enrolling. Thank you for listening in.
Hi, this is Dr. Paul Sachs from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. and I'm going to cover studies of pregnancy and in treatment-naive subjects. These are studies that were presented at AIDS 2020 that was virtual this year, but took place in San Francisco and Oakland. So the first thing I'm going to cover is updated results from the famous SIPAMO study, which was an observational study prospective of women who conceived while receiving the drug dolutegravir or other antiretroviral agents. As has been reported previously, initially they reported a nearly 1% incidence of neural tube defects in babies who were born to women who conceived while receiving dolutegravir. Updated results published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year showed that it was significantly lower, down to 0.3%. And now they get to present additional data. Following over 3,000 exposures, they found 7 neural tube defects. This brought the incidence of neural tube defects down to 0.19%, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.09 and 0.40. Why is this important? This is important because with this lower incidence, the difference between those who have dolutegravir at conception exposure and those who do not is no longer statistically significant. It is still numerically higher, and it's numerically higher than those who had efavirenz conception. But what this does is it gives us reassurance that women can be treated with dolutegravir even if they are of childbearing potential and potentially want to have babies. I suspect that this will lead to further loosening of the guidelines and less worry in clinical practice for use of dolutegravir in women of childbearing potential. An additional study was a meta-analysis of 5 clinical trials in pregnant women. These clinical trials have compared dolutegravir versus efavirenz, and many of them have reported a higher proportion of those with viral loads less than 200 at the time of delivery. So the question asked, did this mean that dolutegravir was safer during pregnancy than efavirenz from the perspective of preventing maternal-to-child transmission? The overall results are that 90% of women who take dolutegravir during pregnancy have an undetectable viral load at delivery versus 72% in the efavirenz arm. Some of these studies, the women started therapy late in pregnancy. In fact, that's not the case. 1% of the women who took dolutegravir during pregnancy had babies with HIV infection versus 0% of those who took efavirenz. This is numerically, but not statistically significantly higher. In addition, there was a borderline statistically significant increase in stillbirths with a higher proportion occurring in the dolutegravir arm. What this is telling us is that viral suppression is not the only factor that we should look at when we examine the safety of treatment during pregnancy. I will say that overall right now, however, I still feel like dolutegravir is a good choice for women during pregnancy. And then the last study I'm going to cover is a predictive model of whether the weight gain that occurs with dolutegravir plus TAF-FTC could be harmful to women during pregnancy. It is derived from the ADVANCE study, which had a randomization to TAF-FTC plus dolutegravir, TDF-FTC plus dolutegravir, or TDF-FTC efavirenz, and took place in South Africa. In this study, as you recall, treatment-emergent obesity at 96 weeks occurred in 14% of those with TAF-FTC dolutegravir, 8% in TDF-FTC dolutegravir, and 2% of TDF-FTC efavirenz. So what they did in this study is they predicted whether there would be adverse maternal outcomes for obesity based on a systemic review of the literature. And they looked at preterm delivery, gestational hypertension, gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, postpartum hemorrhage, and cesarean section. What they did was then said, if these obesity occurs at the proportion found in the advanced study, there would be an additional 53 cases of these adverse maternal outcomes for the TAF-FTC dolutegravir, 28 cases for TDF-FTC dolutegravir, and 4 cases for the TDF-FTC efavirenz. They did the same thing for adverse infant outcomes, large for gestational age, macrosomia, small for gestational age, neonatal death, stillbirth, and neural tube defects. And they found that there would be 24 additional cases for the TAF-FTC arm, 13 additional for TDF-FTC arm, and 3 additional cases in TDF-FTC efavirenz arm. Now, remember, this is a predictive model. They didn't actually see these because they didn't have that many pregnancies. But this was the idea, was that women who are taking this to experience obesity may have these maternal and infant adverse outcomes. So to summarize, the take-home messages from these pregnancy studies In May of 2018, the Sapamo study estimated that 1 out of 100 births to women who took dolutegravir at conception might have a neural tube defect. This is now reduced to 2 per 1,000 births, still numerically higher than comparators, but no longer statistically significant. For dolutegravir versus efavirenz meta-analysis, despite a faster time to viral suppression, there was no evidence for reduced risk of maternal-to-child transmission or to higher infant safety. In the advanced study, they had a projected increase in obesity-related adverse events to dolutegravir TAF-FDC, but these issues were not seen, I should emphasize, in the IMPACT 2010 study, where the strategy was associated with the fewest adverse pregnancy outcomes. Let me shift now and talk about studies in treatment-naive individuals. The first thing I'm going to cover is the estimated time from HIV infection to diagnosis based on CDC data. The good news here is that we've gotten better from 2014 to 2018 in reducing the time from infection to acquiring infection to getting a diagnosis. That's so important because 38% of the new HIV infections in this country occur from undiagnosed people with HIV transmitting to others. There's a difference between race, age, and race ethnicity, with a longer delay in older individuals and a longer delay in minorities than there are in younger individuals and whites, respectively. There weren't very many new studies in treatment-naive individuals, comparative studies, but they did have a 96-week result of the NAMSL study. The NAMSL study, as you might recall, was a randomization to either dolutegravir 50 milligrams or efavirenz 400 milligrams, along with TDF-3TC. It was conducted in the Cameroon, and the randomization, each arm had over 300 participants. The important thing about the Mansell study is that the baseline characteristics had a very high proportion of individuals with advanced HIV disease. 66% had a viral load greater than 100,000, 31% had a viral load greater than 500,000, and the median CD4 cell count was 281, with 33% having a CD4 cell count less than 200. The NAMSL study primary results at 96 weeks are very similar to the primary results at 48 weeks, despite a faster time to initial virologic suppression in the dolutegravir arm. In fact, the two arms were virtually indistinguishable at week 96. The differences was largely the incidence of resistance. In dolutegravir arm, none of the patients who remained on dolutegravir developed resistance versus 17 out of 303 in the efavirenz arm. And then there was an interesting cross-study comparison called a network meta-analysis comparing dolutegravir lamivudine, the two-drug regimen, the only one that's in the DHHS guidelines, versus a bunch of three-drug regimens that have been tested in prospective clinical trials. The efficacy endpoints looked at were virologic suppression and CD4 cell count change, as well as safety endpoints. What the efficacy endpoints demonstrated was that the dolutegravir lamivudine arm was as good as the triple therapy comparators in virtually every study. In fact, it was significantly better than the darunavir-ritonavir plus TDF-FTC arm. But, you know, if you look down the list of various regimens tested in clinical trials, they're all the favorites are there, bictegravir, TAF-FTC, dolutegravir, et cetera, and dolutegravir-lamivudine was just as good. Very interesting is that the CD4 cell count changes in most of the studies favored dolutegravir lamivudine. Whether these CD4 differences are really any clinical significance is unclear. And then last thing I'm going to cover is the islatravir and doravirine phase 2 study. And just mention very quickly that in this study, there were some individuals who had HIV RNA greater than 50 at the study endpoint and counted as virologic failures. They were virologic failures if they had viral rebound or non-response. And when we look at these individuals, there were 6 overall, 5 of them in this islatravir doravirine arm and 1 in the doravirine 3TC TDF arm. Important thing to mention is that all of the participants with virologic failure had confirmatory viral loads that were still quite low, less than 80 copies per ml, and that none of the participants in the study met criteria for resistance testing. So we can't even report what was selected by this combination. In addition, several of the people in this study continued to have low-level viremia even after the study and after switching to alternative regimens. Probably the most interesting thing about this study was they mentioned the phase 3 program for development of doravirine islatravir, and that includes both a heavily treatment-experienced study because islatravir has such high intracellular concentrations and is active against most resistant NRTI-resistant variants. A switch study from virologically suppressed on any baseline ART, but that's open label, a double-blind study with bictegravir FTC TAF switching, and a treatment-naive study versus bictegravir FTC TAF. So the take-home messages from this naive section is that the time from HIV infection to diagnosis significantly improved from 2014 to 18, although delayed diagnosis remains substantial. In particular, I should mention that there were longer delays in Blacks, Latinos, older adults, and males with sexual transmission. The NAMSL study, despite a very high proportion of individuals with very high viral loads, they had dolutegravir and efavirenz both achieved viral suppression in a high proportion. Oh, I should mention that there was a lower virologic response rate in both arms in the patients with the most advanced disease. The cross-study comparisons shows that dolutegravir-lamivudine is effective as multiple triple therapy regimens with an interestingly better CD4 response, although the clinical significance is unclear, and that there were very few participants in the doravirine-islatravir phase 2 study with virologic failure, and none of them met criteria for resistance testing. And there's a very active program of development of this two-drug regimen ongoing. Thanks very much for your attention.
Hi, this is Jose Arribas from La Paz Hospital in Madrid, Spain, reporting from Virtual AIDS 2020. I'm going to comment on antiretroviral studies in experienced people living with HIV. And we have seen a very interesting study. Actually, it's an ACTG trial performed in resource-limited settings, looking at third-line ART. So these are patients with a lot of resistance who have failed two lines of ART. And they divided up the cohorts that they treated in the clinical trial. But basically, everybody was either resistant to lopinavir, ritonavir, or resistant to all nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And the investigators have to design regimens based on darunavir, ritonavir, raltegravir, or etravirine, and recycle nucleosides. So overall, third-line therapy, these results, limited settings with this type of trio-like combinations, was pretty good. After 192 weeks of follow-up, 80% of the participants were undetectable. Obviously, those who achieve the lower rate of undetectability was the cohort that have more resistance to darunavir. But as long as darunavir was still sensitive and you can combine it with either raltegravir or etravirine, or again, surprisingly enough, with recycled nucleosides did very well. So we have a very good third-line regimen in resource-limited settings that could be even better if they could get access to all the new drugs that we have for resistance HIV. And in this same topic of treatment resource-limited settings, there is a recommendation from the WHO that when a patient fails a first-line regimen based on an NRTI, the second regimen has to optimize the background, the nucleosides. And it specifically recommends to go away, to switch away from tenofovir difumarate and to start ACT. And there is a very interesting study performed more than 1,000 participants in Haiti that look at the outcomes in people who followed and people who didn't follow this recommendation. So there were people who did switch from TDF to ACT and people who stay on TDF, and everybody got a boosted PI, either lopinavir, ritonavir, or atazanavir, ritonavir. And in contrary to the WH recommendation, people who stay on TDF did better than people who switched to ACT. The basis of the recommendation is that many times in these cohorts, there is K65R, and ACT is fully active with K65R. But despite that finding, people who stay on TDF did better than people who switched to ACT in terms of achieving virological response. And this is probably due to better compliance with TDF because ACT has to be given BID. And also because the ACT's tolerance is worse than with TDF. There has been also a lot of research in the last few years about dual therapies. We have seen the presentation at this meeting of another study in virologically suppressed participants in Spain on triple drug therapy without prior failures who were switched to continue this regimen, triple drug antiretroviral therapy, or switch to a dual regimen of dolutegravir 3TC. It included 165 patients. Bottom line, very few virologic failures, met non-inferiority, and no resistance mutations were detected, further supporting the use of dolutegravir 3TC. There was a sub-analysis of the TANGO study that compared also in virologically suppressed participants on a TAF-based regimen, the continuation of this TAF-based regimen versus switching to dolutegravir and 3TC. And instead of looking just at proportion of patients below 40 copies per ml, they look at this other endpoint that is target not detected. This is when the PCR tells you that there is no trace of RNA in the sample. And no matter the week, people receiving the dolutegravir 3TC were as suppressed with target not detected as people who continue a TAF-based regimen. There has been also another interesting analysis of a Gilead trial. This is trial 4030. It's an interesting trial because it's also in the setting of maintenance therapy. Adults who are suppressed taking dolutegravir plus FTC TAF or dolutegravir plus FTC TDF, they are randomized to switch to VF TAF or to the dolutegravir plus FTAF. The singularity of this trial is allowed people with a history of nucleoside resistance, either by history or by DNA genotyping. So almost one quarter of the participants had nucleoside resistance, and some of them had bad resistance, K65R, or more than three times. The results of the study have been presented before, and we know that these two regimens, even in the presence of archived resistance, didn't lead to virologic failure. But in this presentation, they have looked at blips, and the bottom line is also that there were no more blips in people who had archived resistance when they were switched to VF-TAF or dolutegravir with FTAF. And the other main topic in experienced patients is long-acting therapy. It's another of the hot topics in the conferences. So here we've seen a couple of interesting surveys in investigators who participated in the ATLAS-2N trial that was presented at CROI. So they did a survey that included almost 300 providers from 13 countries and five continents. And they were asked how feasible they thought it was going to be the implementation of long-acting therapy. And approximately two-thirds of the providers reported that this considered that this could be very feasible. And one-third said that there were going to be issues implementing long-acting. And the main issues related to the implementation of long-acting IM antiretroviral therapy is the issues of travel to the clinic, the time spent traveling to the clinic, and issues also with cost. Those are the main barriers to implementing these regimens. The benefits, most of the providers thought that is issues with the lifestyle of the patients that improves, issues with convenience, and issues with disclosure and less stigma. And the big fears of the providers are the patients do not come back for the next shot, and they can become resistant because we know these drugs have a very long half-life and a long tail after they discontinue therapy. So those are the big fears. And I found interesting a very small study of 35 participants that really needed parenteral therapy because issues with compliance, because they have very bad psychological problems, or they have structural problems that lead to malabsorption of the drugs. So they needed parenteral therapy. And it's a nice observation that these 35 participants, some of them, 28, started with detectable viral load. In the majority, they achieve undetectability. So these are going to be the first candidates for long-acting, people who really need parenteral therapy because they cannot take pills. So I consider that an interesting experience. So, and finally, we saw a very detailed analysis of the resistance profile of doravirine. Doravirine is a new NNRTI that is different from prior ones. It's very active, doesn't have CNS adverse effects, and has a higher genetic barrier than the prior NNRTIs. So in this detailed analysis of more than 4,000 patient samples, it's clear that it's very rare to find a sample with a single NNRTI mutation that confers resistance to doravirine. Actually, doravirine remains sensitive in a substantial number of samples that are resistant to efavirenz or nevirapine. It's less so with rilpivirine and etravirine. But the take-home message is that single mutations, either the common K103N or 181C, do not confer resistance to doravirine. You need at least 4 or 5 mutations to confer resistance to doravirine, with 2 exceptions. One is 188L and the other is 318F. So doravirine is a nice option for people who still have mutations related to prior NNRTIs. So those were the studies that I consider more relevant in experienced patients in virtual AIDS 2020. Thank you for your attention.
Hello, my name is Graham Moyle from the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. I'm going to talk about some of the issues around comorbidity at the virtual IAS 2020 conference. The big theme in this area at the conference was weight change, where there were many presentations regarding different aspects of weight gain. The first one I wanted to mention was data from the Kaiser Permanente group that looked at subjects with HIV and subjects who were HIV negative and looked at weight change over time. Now, the first thing to note in their cohort is that people who were HIV positive at the time of presentation were actually lower in weight than their HIV negative peers. But after the initiation of antiretroviral therapy, people with HIV gained weight approximately 3 times faster, about 0.22 kilograms per meter squared of BMI each year, compared with the general population with just 0.9 kilograms per meter squared of BMI. So the HIV population caught up with the general population. Now, if you then focused on people who are actually HIV positive and already normal weight or overweight or obese at baseline, what happened was that those people were actually quite similar to their HIV negative peers, and then they became more overweight or progressed from being normal weight to overweight during follow-up on therapy, suggesting that there was an ongoing weight gain that was different in people with HIV than what one sees in the general population. This is similar data that was reported from the ADVANCE study, where we saw some update through 144 weeks in that study. And what we see particularly in women in the study was an ongoing weight gain out beyond 96 weeks through 144 weeks, with substantial amounts of weight gain greater in the TAF-FTC dolutegravir than the TDF-FTC dolutegravir, with the lowest amounts of weight gain in the TDF-FTC efavirenz group. We know from Mexico there'd been some data that showed that there was a relationship between efavirenz metabolizer status and weight gain, that if you were a slow metabolizer of efavirenz, you actually had weight gain fairly similar to dolutegravir. So there was differences between dolutegravir and efavirenz, and also differences between TAF and TDF-based regimens. So at the end of 3 years, women who were randomized to TAF-FTC dolutegravir had gained 12.3 kilograms versus those with TDF and dolutegravir 7.4, and those on TDF efavirenz just 5.5 kilograms. And of course, not surprisingly with this, there was also some treatment emergent obesity. Very similar data were reported from the NAMSOL study in Cameroon, which compared dolutegravir and efavirenz 400 milligrams with TDF 3TC. And again, statistically significant greater weight gain over 96 weeks with dolutegravir, averaging 5 kilograms versus about 3.4 kilograms in the efavirenz group in that study. There were also data from the ARIA study, which was an all-women study comparing atazanavir ritonavir with dolutegravir in women commencing antiretroviral therapy. And again here, the dolutegravir group was associated with greater amounts of weight gain, about 2.5 kilograms over 48 weeks, relative to less than 1.5 kilograms in those who received atazanavir. In this case, the backbones were abacavir 3TC with dolutegravir and tenofovir FTC with atazanavir. So multiple studies pointing to differences in choices in first-line treatment. Then we had some further cohort data from the OPERA cohort, which has representative sites around multiple places in the United States, which looked at weight change before and after individuals switched from tenofovir DF to tenofovir allafenamide. And what they noted within this study was that around the time of switch, there was, as it were, an inflection in the weight change, so that there was an accelerated weight gain that lasted about 9 months and then plateaued after one had switched from TDF to TAF. Now, if we look at those previous studies, we get the idea that there may be either a weight gain effect of TAF or a protection against weight gain with TDF. And so what one sees in this cohort is probably the removal of that weight protection effect from TDF, allowing people to have an accelerated weight gain, which then plateaus quite rapidly, and can mean that if we're changing our patients from TDF to TAF, we can advise them that they may gain a little bit of weight because of the change of medication, and warn them to take appropriate lifestyle action and reassure them that this effect is transient and that they will subsequently see a stabilization in the weight. I think in support of that hypothesis, what we see from two studies, the TANGO study and the DOLOM study, is that in patients who were switched in TANGO specifically away from a TAF-based regimen to a two-drug regimen of dolutegravir 3TC, there were no differences in change in weight overall, the change in weight in individuals who'd only recently started TAF before entering the study was slightly greater, but the same in both groups, regardless of whether you removed or didn't remove TAF at that point, suggesting that probably as you were removing TAF, but you still saw the same amount of weight gain, it was probably the prior removal of TDF that had been relevant to that weight gain. Once you were over 1 year, the rate of weight increase slowed down. And there were similar rates of individuals who gained more than 10% of their body weight in each group. Again, in the DOLAM study, people switching to dolutegravir 3TC versus continuing a range of different three-drug regimens saw actually significantly greater weight increase in the group who changed to the two-drug regimen, with some variation in what was observed in terms of limb and trunk fat, in part because of differences in baseline characteristics. There are also data reported from the DRIVE SHIFT study, which looked at a different option, the option of using doravirine as a switch agent. And in this case, individuals were randomized to switch immediately or after 24 weeks. And the trajectory of weight gain after switching to doravirine was very modest, so that at the end of 144 weeks of follow-up, the change in weight was in fact only about 1 to 1.5 kilograms, less than what was reported in those other studies, suggesting that doravirine doesn't have a significant weight impact. What about with bictegravir, which is of course available only as a single tablet formulation with TAF-FTC? Well, there was some data from four different studies looking at patients switching to bictegravir from either Triumeq or from TAF-FTC dolutegravir, and looking specifically at the over 65 group, which is a group that had been flagged by the FDA as where there was limited data with bictegravir. And over a one-year period, there was only a 1 kilogram change in weight, underlining again this absence of clear relationship. There was some additional cohort data that reported the relationship between women and weight gain or weight change, and people of Black African origin and greater amounts of weight change, and this idea that perhaps older individuals may be less prone to weight gain after switch. Just briefly to cover some of the other comorbidities, some nice data from Jeannie Triant at Harvard looking at the predicted versus actual cardiovascular event score using a range of different calculators such as the Framingham Risk Calculator, and applying that to their cohort as well as to the Kaiser Permanente cohort, more predominantly in California, showing that the Framingham Risk Calculator underestimated the risk in both men and women of seeing events, so that we always, when we're using those calculators, need to add a few points of risk on. Some data from the ADVANCE study, which looked at the emergence of the metabolic syndrome using one of the four well-known metabolic syndrome definitions, but in this case using the only one that it uses BMI, because of course they had no waist circumference data within the study to apply. And not surprising, given that there was more weight gain in people who were randomized to TAF-FTC dolutegravir, there was more treatment-emergent metabolic syndrome in both men and women who were randomized that group relative to the TDF-FTC group or the dolutegravir group or the TDF-FTC efavirenz group. And that the emergence of metabolic syndrome was more common in women, in part because weight gain was greater in women in the study than it was in men. What about in terms of that switch to TAF-FTC bictegravir in over 65s? Well, what was seen during follow-up is very minimal changes in lipids, so small downward change in cholesterol and in triglyceride levels with a 0.2 point change in the ratio of total cholesterol to HDL, and a small decrement in eGFR, about minus 2.7%, probably related to the effect of Biktarvy on calculated eGFR using creatinine. Similar data with switching to dolutegravir 3TC in the TANGO study, small changes in lipids that was largely driven in this study by the removal of booster agents such as ritonavir or cobicistat from the combination, but overall favoured the two-drug regimen for that lipid outcome. And again, in that study, also some improvements in fasting insulin sensitivity and glucose. So overall, the main focus of the study for comorbidities about weight change, lots of data to generate discussion, but no clear answers as to what are the mechanisms, and certainly the data in terms of switching, such as the removal of TAF from a regimen, didn't seem to result in any improvements in weight over time. So this is going to be an ongoing area of interest and focus. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Marta Buffito and I work at Chelsea Westminster Hospital in London in the United Kingdom. I'm going to go through the most interesting presentations from Virtual AIDS 2020 on the pharmacology of antiretroviral treatments and other co-medications that people living with HIV may take. Very importantly, there was a presentation on the low-dose single tablet regimen containing elvitegravir, cobicistat, FTC, and TAF in children between 2 and 6 years old of age and weighting between 14 and 25 kilos. And this is really important because it is a knowledge gap. There were no data in children below the age of 6 years old. And importantly, the concentrations of the drugs are above the IC90, and they are very similar to those measured for adults. The drugs were well tolerated. There were some gastrointestinal adverse events, but no grade 3 adverse events or adverse events related discontinuations. There were obviously some presentations on drug-drug interactions. There was presentations on the interactions between doravirine and rifabutin, advising to double the doravirine dose to 100 milligrams twice a day when co-administered with the moderate inducer of cytochrome P450-3A4 rifabutin. There was an interesting presentation from a Dolphin 2 sub-study that looked at pregnant women in sub-Saharan Africa, especially in Uganda and South Africa, where the Dolphin 2 study was conducted. And it showed that pregnant women in Uganda take traditional medicines that may contain high levels of cations and may interact with integrase inhibitor affecting their absorption. This was indeed innovative and interesting. Moving on, there were some data on the new drug lenacapavir, which is GS6207. It is the long-acting capsid inhibitor developed by Gilead. So they looked at these drugs within a new formulation, which is a sustained delivery formulations. They administered it to healthy volunteers in a phase one study, and they showed that this formulation supports a 6 months dosing interval. So very good news for long-acting treatments. And very importantly, there was a study from the Janssen team looking at bridging potential missed doses of long-acting rilpivirine with oral rilpivirine given 25 milligrams once daily. And importantly, they concluded that oral bridge with 25 milligrams of rilpivirine once a day can be followed by a 600 milligrams rilpivirine long-acting injection if the time between injections is 2 months or less, but the loading dose of 900 milligrams would need to be readministered if the interval between the injections is longer than 2 months. We also reviewed some data on pharmacology of PrEP. There were data on the pharmacokinetics and safety of long-acting TAF implants in macaques for HIV prevention that showed that the concentrations of tenofovir diphosphate intracellularly are maintained over time when the implant is used. And finally, there was a very interesting sub-study from the HPTN-069 study looking at tissues, infectivity, and drug concentrations in colon tissue in women and MSM and transgender women. So importantly, they saw that people who took part in the study that involved the administration of maraviroc versus maraviroc plus TDF versus maraviroc plus FTC versus TDF plus FTC showed that women seem to have higher levels in colon tissue of P24 antigen than men or transgender women, and also seem to have lower concentrations of the drugs. And this is very interesting, and it leaves us with a lot of questions. So are these HIV susceptibility differences also seen in clinical practice? And what is the biological mechanism of these gender differences? And does it mean that PrEP dosing requirements are actually different in different genders? And this is it. Thank you for listening.
This concludes our audio podcast entitled Rapid Fire Review of AIDS 2020. This program was produced by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Viral Ed, Inc. As a reminder, to submit questions, please send an email to viraledcme@viraled.com. Questions will be answered by one of our faculty panel members via email within 72 hours. To receive CME credit for completing this activity, please go to www.cmeuniversity.com, then click on Find Post-Test Evaluation by Course on the navigation menu, enter the CME code 15228, and complete the evaluation to receive your certificate. For more CME programming on AIDS 2020, please visit www.viraled.com. Thank you for your participation.